We're here this morning. This is WCOM, LP, Chapel Hill, and Carrboro. This is the program, Carrboro Book Beat, that features reviews and interviews devoted to the literary life of Carrboro and the Greater Triangle area. Your hosts are Paul Nagy and Audrey Layton, that's me, on the airwaves here, as well as being webcast live, courtesy of iBiblio on www.communityradio.coop. To find out about our schedule of guests and to access our show podcasts, go to www.carrborobookbeat.com. I'll give you a little heads up about what's going on at the Carrboro Branch Library. They invite you to their weekly children's programs, and this week they'll be having a special evening story on Thursday, evening story hour on Thursday, December 18th. From 6:30 to 7:30, there will be fun for the whole family as they read The Polar Express and enjoy cookies, hot chocolate, and a winter craft. You can call them at 969-3006 to find out more about that. And on Saturday, they're going to be enjoying stories about snow and the winter solstice. So give the library a call. They're located at McDougal Middle School at 900 Old Fayetteville Road in Chapel Hill.
Do you think that's wishful thinking? Do you really think that they want to have snow for Christmas? You really think that they have this that's just going to bring in the ghost of snow or whatever?
It's stories about snow. And you know, I've always thought it should start snowing Christmas Eve, and we should all be snowed in until New Year's Day. Yep. And then the snow should melt magically overnight, and then that's enough until the next year.
Yeah. Well, I'm a true Californian. I think you should visit snow rather than snow visit you.
Well, let's say thank you to our underwriter. Carrboro BookBeat greatly appreciates the support of the Regulator Bookshop. This is an independent, locally owned community bookstore located at 720 9th Street in Durham. The Regulator brings authors from around the community and around the world to read from and sign copies of their works. The telephone number to find out more about that is 286-2700. Their website is www.regbook.com. That's R-E-G-B-O-O-K. From now until Christmas, the Regulator will be collecting donations for the Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina's Durham branch. Customers can drop contributions by the store, and staff will see that they get to the food bank and then distribute it to the people who need it most. For a lot of people, times are tougher now than they've been for many years. Donating food is a very direct way to help out. Telephone number is 286-2700, again, for more information on the best kind of items to donate. That's our business talk for the morning, and now we can get to the our special, very special guest today, Jackie Shelton Green, our new and first and forever first Piedmont Poet Laureate. That is such a great, I mean, it's just great, that's all.
So who were these people who decided they represented the Piedmont to make you the laureate of it anyway? Yes, obviously, and very bright, but we're just curious about.
The Orange County Arts Commission, the Raleigh Arts Commission, the Durham Arts Council, and
there's another
and
one.
And all
there,
the good, smart people in this place.
Right, and a couple of other art commissions and
in Raleigh.
In the Raleigh area. Great, great. But I thought the Piedmont was farther west than the Raleigh. Is Raleigh still a part of the Piedmont? We're talking about the geographic.
Yeah, I think
What are the characteristics of the
because
Piedmont?
Because it's Research Triangle, and I guess it starts at Yanceyville or something, or whatever's down there.
I think so. I think these entities came together to create this first position.
Uh-huh.
And I once heard that it was also to assist our fabulous poet laureate, who has done an incredible job of spanning herself across the state.
You mean the one
that's
the state?
A lot of driving,
yes,
I guess,
considering
how long we are.
But to have someone right here in the triangle.
Right.
I'm excited. Very excited.
Does this mean you have to write official doggerel for you know, when there's change in offices and stuff, when the mayor comes by. Oh, excuse me. I didn't mean it that way, or did I?
Well, so far I have not been commissioned or mandated to write any official poetry, but I really see this as an ambassadorship. I also see this as an incredible opportunity to interface with so many other poets in the Piedmont, because there are so many poets and there are so many community-based organizations that are doing wonderful work in the arts. And we all know that poetry is sometimes way down on the list of literature.
So it's actually one of the most intricate and difficult of artistic forms, even though everybody thinks they know how to speak, therefore they could be a poet.
This is true, but what's fascinating now is that I really appreciate and celebrate the level that especially young people have taken poetry to. Spoken word and choreography and music. It's just fabulous. I think it's fabulous that people who traditionally don't read poetry, don't write poetry. I mean, you can gather thousands of people to a poetry slam. There's a lot of bad stuff that goes on in terms of written word at poetry slams, but there are some fascinating, wonderful celebration of craft and really good work that is happening. So I'm excited as a old poet to see what the energy and the talent and the aptitude and the intellect of how people are stretching the classics, daring to stretch the classics and the canon, because there's also, for as many people who appreciate and love this art form, there are people who are saying, that's not poetry. But for many of us who come from a community-based constituency, we understand how to listen for poetry. And we understand that it shows up on Sunday morning in prayer. We understand it's the click-click of little girls outside on the on the sidewalk playing hopscotch. We know it's the pots and pans of mom rattling in the kitchen. So giving permission to a larger group of people to express their poetic vernacular is very important.
Right. Do you feel like in the Piedmont area you really have a rich base to tap into? And I'm thinking, just thinking of here in Carrboro, because we have, Carrboro has a poet laureate.
That's right.
We've had youth poetry contests. And
Hillsborough has a poet laureate.
Right, right. So it's at least in this part of the Piedmont, we seem to be ready for you, Jackie.
Well, I am preparing to be ready. And I'm very interested in interfacing with public schools. Very interested in interfacing with public schools. Very interested in discovering, exploring what community-based organizations are already doing. We didn't invent poetry programs. They're here. They're alive. They're fresh. Many are underground. But I'm excited about bringing those voices to a table.
Right.
And having them decide what that table looks like.
Right.
And having the Piedmont have a different appreciation for poetics in a very different way.
We're going to do a little sliding over here of mics, so we can include Richard Brown. Hi, Richard. I'm glad you stayed around.
Thank you.
Okay. As people probably know, Richard just did the show ahead of us. And that is, again, we sometimes have the Marley's ghost here rattling his chains. So do they give you a certain, as Paul was saying, if you're going to have to write official doggerel, I mean,
they don't actually have you do that.
Do they have a sort of script for you or things that they ask you to be prepared to do for them?
Oh, yes. I have a wonderful schedule that's forthcoming. Starting December 31st, Chuck Davis and I are the official masters, mistress of ceremony of the big ball drop at First Raleigh.
Whoa.
So in the beginning of the evening, around 6, families and children gather. So there's a ball drop for the children.
Right, right.
And Chuck Davis and I will.
What time is the ball drop for the kids? About
6 o'clock.
Six o'clock.
Okay. So that's fun. So Chuck and I have met, and we're going to do sort of a call and response with the audience and with families. Mm-hmm. I won't give it all away.
That's great.
But I'm writing something for the children.
Oh, that's right.
So that's my first big debut.
Uh-huh.
And then I have several conferences, symposiums, festivals, writers' festivals that are upcoming in 2009 that I'll be participating in.
Right.
So the mission of this new role is really to expand the appreciation of the literary arts in the Piedmont.
And so literary arts in general, not just poetry?
Right, because my understanding is that every other year there would be a poet, the next year there would be a fiction writer. So the first year was to launch it with a poet.
Okay. That's fantastic. So the next one would be called what? Not a poet laureate, but they'd be called something else?
A fiction laureate.
Yes,
no, I don't think that'll quite work. You know, you're not real, are you? You're a fiction laureate. Yeah.
Anyway. So this seems like it would take up quite a bit of your time.
Yes. But I'm excited. I mean, what better way to spend a year meeting great new people?
Right.
I'm always inspired by my listeners. I'm inspired by children. I'm inspired by communities. I'm inspired by people who are excited about reading and writing.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's kind of like I get to play for a year.
Yes.
And my husband realizes that this is official play. So, you know, when I quit my job in 2004 to write full time, you know, every day he'd come home and it was like, show me your pages. So now I get to play.
This is good.
And it's official, you know. It's been mandated that I play and play hard and have lots of fun.
Well, that's one of the things I was trying to figure out. How do I ask this is, you know, if you are employed full time, how would you possibly do this? So that I know that you were working didn't you work for the Legal Aid Society for a while?
I worked for Legal Services for over 20 years, but left them in 2000 and worked for a nonprofit here in Chapel Hill and left in 2004 to really be present to being a writer and to really engage myself in the work that really is my soul work and my life work.
That was one of the questions I was going to ask, besides, you know, how do you support yourself as a poet, was do you have a regular writing schedule? Because one of the things that I've heard from writers and have tried to discipline myself to unsuccessfully is a regular writing schedule where I'm going to either write so many pages a day or so many hours a day or whatever. And I've always thought of poetry as being more inspiration-driven. You know, you just see something that moves you thoroughly in some way, and you've got to express it.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder, how does that translate into a discipline?
Well, all of my adult life, I've had to balance being a working-class writer. I've had to balance always having a full-time job as a divorced mom of three children, raising children, being a community activist, being very involved in life. So I did not, during that time, have the kind of schedule you're thinking about. But I wrote. I probably wrote more when my children were babies in the wee hours between 2 a.m. and 6 a.m. I would sometimes just write for hours. But in terms of a schedule, I've given myself permission to allow my writing schedules to be a part of a flow, if this is making sense.
Okay.
So I'm not regimented. You know, when I'm working on particular projects or something very specific, like a manuscript that my publisher is screaming at me about, I'm very disciplined and can set aside entire days where I get up at 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning. and I'm in my room of my own, mm-hmm. where I do my writing, and I can be there mm-hmm. for 12 hours.
Mm-hmm.
You know, tea breaks, pee breaks.
Mm-hmm.
I can be there right. for 12 hours. But in my natural flow of life,
mm-hmm.
I'm a mom,
mm-hmm.
I'm a daughter
mm-hmm.
to an elderly mother
mm-hmm.
and aunt. I'm a wife.
Mm-hmm.
Very liberated wife, but still a wifey. So for me, you know, making dinner is a
right.
part of the organic process
right.
of writing. I'm always writing.
Mm-hmm.
I may not be scribing, but
okay.
making
like
the
that.
Soup is
mm-hmm.
a part of the process.
Mm-hmm.
Standing there, you know, chopping, sometimes I'm really revising lines.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's always had to be organic.
Right.
And it's had to be the substantive flow that I can reach into
mm-hmm.
and not be restrained and restricted by putting it in this box of I write from 9 until 12.
Right.
You know, this is interesting because we've had other writers on the show address this.
Mm-hmm.
And they're male writers, and there may be a difference. This is Mr. Sexist Stereotype talking here now. But they tend to, you know, the way they've talked about it is the classic, you know, I get up in the morning and I'll take 2 or 3 hours where I'll do, you know, stream, you know, whatever comes writing. And then I take another hour or two after that where I do revision, either of what I just wrote or of other things that I wrote. And then I stop and I go off and I do my other things.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of compartmentalization seems to work really well for certain kinds of writers. Whereas the way you seem to be talking about it is for you, this sort of reverie of the wordplay or the nuance of meaning or dream or image that's in you, it's just going to come. It's just going to bubble up and flow at any kind of time. And that's, I'm not going to say that's more womanish, but we'll just say that's just a real different way of approaching things.
Well, it's, you're not being quite sexist in that. I mean, because it's true that at least research and et cetera, has shown that men will compartmentalize more than women. And women
that's true.
Are more
that's
in
when,
a flowing.
When women right. start talking to us, we can't hear them because we're not there. We haven't decompartmentalized to hear. And I've seen this amazing. I've seen this in myself amazing. Oh, I'm sorry. I really wanted to hear you, but I didn't know I was supposed to pay attention then. you gotta wave a flag in front of me and say, listen now, you know.
Well, you know, it's not the intellectual container that I'm always tapping into.
Right, right.
And I write a lot. I wake up and there's something just sitting there
uh-huh.
that wakes me up.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And I give it attention.
Uh-huh.
I right then and there I get up and I go dance with it.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes I dance for the next 4 or 5 hours.
Right.
So
you're open and waiting, you know, a good receptacle for what is flowing up.
Right. And you know, from my dream space, from one of the things that I do is I collect kind of interesting news stories.
Mm-hmm.
So yesterday I came across this story of a young child in upstate New York. I think seventh grader, her history teacher had reenacted slavery by binding two young African-American children's hands and legs together.
Mm-hmm.
Well, last week I cut out a story about five hands that were found floating in a river. So material comes
Whoa.
To me from a
right,
variety
right.
of sources. Material comes from me when I'm sweeping off the deck.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm particularly interested in the cadence and rhythm of
mm-hmm.
A particular obnoxious woodpecker
mm-hmm.
In the backyard. So I can't compartmentalize that.
Right.
I just like gather and collect and just I have all of these containers
mm-hmm.
Of you know, memory and vision and dreams, mm-hmm. and so the work is there.
Right.
This is Richard. Can I ask a question? Are you trying to do you come at it from, I don't know, I wouldn't call it necessarily call it a male perspective, but do you come at it from, I'm collecting all these different pieces and I have a goal that I'm interested in with this particular piece, or you just say, I'm going to collect it and then start to, like a quilt, pull it together?
Like a quilt, and, you know, when I'm teaching and teaching journal writing particularly, I use journals like bank deposits. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what do we do with our bank deposits? We have a savings, we have a checking account, we make deposits. We're continually making deposits into our account. And then we make withdrawals. So last week was a very busy week. I just didn't write. I didn't have time to sit down and write. But I was gathering. Mm-hmm. I have like half pages. I have two or three words. I have clippings. I have some photographs. I have pieces of music I just discovered. Mm-hmm. All of that stuff physically goes into a basket. It goes somewhere. So next week is a different week for me. I sit down and I look at all of these pieces for my quilt or this tapestry that I want to put together. Do I have a mission? No. I allow those objects, those stories, to speak to me. I allow myself to hear whatever piqued my interest in the beginning, whatever, you know, in this feather I found at a friend's backyard. I don't know why I picked up the feather, but it will tell me. It's instructional, if that makes sense. And that's how I use my... I have tons of books all over the house and the car and other people's cars and other people's houses. So I'm always gathering. Let me give you an example. I was invited to be a writer in residence at a fabulous artist colony down in Portobello, Panama. And I took like 8 journals down with me. And I just had all of this rich material. Well, I came back with a manuscript. I had no idea what was going to work, what was going to fit. But I used that time for my residency to address nothing but my journals. So all of the work that I produced came out of that account that I had been making pretty big and regular deposits for an entire year. And I don't have to open them. So I opened them, a year later? Mm-hmm. And was like blown away. Mm-hmm. One entire journal was me walking through an incredible exhibit in Texas at a university. It was an exhibit on the history of writing. It just blew my mind. So I was making just copious notes just all over the place and, you know, taking little shots of scrolls and calligraphy. And, you know, I was fascinated to learn that, you know, the Quran was written on linen rags. And that image of writing on linen rags just mm-hmm. moved me tremendously. So I'm inspired just about anything. Cake batter, cat litter.
Like maybe that's what makes the writer.
Well, when you mentioned putting things in baskets, I remember that was how we were instructed in one course how to do sermons. You know, I've got a ministry background, and so, you know, we'd go through the week and people would come with their stories and their concerns, which you always bring that. You know, maybe address them out loud in the sermon, but you always might suggest them to people who are needing to know. You know, you have, there's lots of hidden messages in a good sermon. So you put all the stuff, but you put it in this basket, you know. Mm-hmm. But you put the stuff in the basket, and then, you know, when it comes down to shaping it together, you know, think about who's there.
You talk a lot about how the things come.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have an audience in mind when you write?
An open ear.
Uh-huh.
And an open heart.
So you're not writing specifically for women or for youth or for African Americans or for just anyone there who could respond to the same flow of energy that you're putting out.
It is my intention when I'm writing that something in my writing taps into something in another human being.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the case that human being shows up in,
mm-hmm.
you know, is totally irrelevant
mm-hmm.
to me. I just, for me, I really believe strongly that the arts have incredible healing and restorative and mm-hmm. regenerative energy and power.
Mm-hmm.
And there is nothing more enlightening for me than when someone who is very much other,
mm-hmm.
different than I am, that my writing has created a bridge, that I become the architect of creating this bridge where we can stand in all of our many shades of difference. But something in the writing
mm-hmm.
Evoked, touched, connected to something in other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where we begin to really be architects of peace, architects of reconciliation,
mm-hmm.
Is using the arts to really step out of our safety zones
mm-hmm.
and to really, I've seen it happen. I've witnessed it. You know, I've witnessed it amongst gang leaders that I've worked with of mm-hmm. different backgrounds who think they're just so different. I've witnessed it between immigrants, you know, who are at just in a lot of conflict with other people. I've witnessed it within the amnesia of the South, of the issues of that face us as black and white people.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen how powerful literature and our stories serve us.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always looking for opportunities to facilitate that digging. I believe we're all human museums
mm-hmm.
and that each and every one of us bring our own anthropology mm-hmm. to the table, and we carry it all the time, 24/7. And for me, the pen is the shovel, is what we dig with.
In some ways we've been discussing your process, and I'm really happy that you're doing this. I'm sure that there's many of our listeners out there might be inspired to pay more, to take more reverence in their own process in terms of what they see and hear, and they know that that's the fodder for good art. But maybe it would be nice to hear a poem or two, or some selection of poems or two, as it were, to see how this bricolage is turned into various forms.
Well, I could do that. Great.
Thanks.
This is a piece that I wrote September 12, 2001. Lifting Veils. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. 1. It is a blood-stained horizon whispering, La ilaha illallah, prelude to a balmy evening that envelops our embrace. We stand reaching across sands, waters, airs full of blood. In the flash of a distant storm, I see you standing on another shore, torn hijab, billowing towards unnamed wind. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. We both wear veils, blood-stained, tear-stained, enshrouding separate truth. 2. Misty morning teardrops of dust choke and stain lips that do not move, will not utter. It is a morning of shadows, shores, sea shadows that caress memory of another time, another veil, another woman needing, reaching, lifting. 3. Into your eyes I swam, searching for veils to lift, to wrap, to pierce, dance with. Veils that elude such mornings, veils that stain such lips, veils tearing like music. 4. It is the covering of spirit, not the body. My hijab, your hijab, connecting, interweaving, crawling, snaking, binding into a sky that will not bend.
Whoa. Mm-hmm. Sitting at it just makes my eyes water. Beautiful, Jackie. Thank you.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's the reaching and the connecting. As you were talking before you read that, I was thinking of Namaste. You know, the God in me greets the God in you, mm-hmm. and it's the human in me greets the human in you, and it doesn't matter. Nothing else matters. It's just mm-hmm. I look in your eyes and see you. So that's one of the things I've kind of preached to people in the past is look in the eye and see the person. Mm-hmm. And that's what your poetry is doing.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, not knowing when that was written, just the day after 9/11, I remember how, we had a spontaneous march here in Chapel Hill against the war. You know, this is before it was declared. Which it was reasonably well covered in, but there was some, I knew that with the administration we had, we weren't going to get a response that made any sense to me, at least. But the thing is that the Muslims that were on that things, it wasn't Bismillah or Rahman or Rahim, it was Allah Akbar.
Allahu Akbar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The war cry. And I know that people in the Muslim world are hurting as much as we are, and they're not the enemy. You know, it's a very difficult time for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
As that shoe tossed on somebody's face is symbolic of.
That was interesting.
Yeah. Let's go and ask, did you know that you were a poet?
I did.
You did. How soon? How young?
When I was very, very young.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure that I could name it.
Right.
But I knew that I would write.
Uh-huh.
I knew I would write. And maybe by the time I became a teenager, I knew I would really write. I knew that I must write. And I've continued to do this. I come from a family, like most families, where reading and writing is very much emphasized. And there was no question about, do you want to go to school? It was, where are you thinking in terms of higher education? But I remember my grandmother, who was an incredibly edumacated woman without formal education, who read everything, mm-hmm. everything, including your letters. Somehow she didn't realize that the mail that came in the mail without her name on it, she was not to read. But my grandmother always impressed upon me that there was something very powerful about reading and about writing and about telling and about witnessing.
Mm-hmm.
And the older, I just grew into that as I grew up. I really grew into that, and I began to just see the power of words. I mean, mm-hmm. you could almost like see words hanging in the air. Or see words before people spoke them, or understood words that were not said.
Mm-hmm.
So I grew up seeking that. I really spent my younger life just kind of allowing words to pull me
mm-hmm.
and to follow them. And they've served me well and as a listener.
Well, there's a magic there, Jackie. I mean, they're really, I think you just carry a magic.
Oh.
So, anyway,
thank you.
Not to get too wordy about that, but you mentioned your grandmother in a lot of your poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, could I ask you to read a particular one that I liked?
Okay.
Yes.
The grandmother one. Well, let me set this poem up a little
bit. Okay, great.
Many years ago, I think in the 80s, the North Carolina Writers Network was doing this really special project where they requested a number of writers and a drummer to go into women's correctional facility. And we actually work with a lot of women on death row.
Mm-hmm.
We did some drumming, we did quilting, we did writing. And then I did a residency that followed up on that, where I got to work only with death row women.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked them for 1 year to write about nothing but hands. But that was the only subject matter that I wanted them to embrace.
Mm-hmm.
Hands, their hands.
Right.
And out of that, the poem you're asking me to write is a piece that came out of mm-hmm. that collection. I know the grandmother one had hands. I know the grandmother one had hands, but they were always in bowls, folding, pinching, rolling the dough, making the bread. I know the grandmother one had hands, but they were always underwater, sifting rice, bluing clothes, starching lives. I know the grandmother one had hands, but they were always in the earth, planting seeds, removing weeds, growing knives, burying sons. I know the grandmother one had hands, but they were always under the cloth, pushing it along, helping it birth into skirt, dress, curtains to lock out night. I know the grandmother one had hands, but they were always inside the hair, parting, plaiting, twisting it into rainbows. I know the grandmother one had hands, but they were always inside pockets, holding the knots, counting the twisted veins, holding onto herself, lest her hands disappear into sky. I know the grandmother one had hands, but they were always inside the clouds, poking holes for the rain to fall.
I love that. Thank you very much.
That is really nice.
Thank you.
Having known a few poets in my life, there are some poems that are readable but not recitable, because the ear can't make sense out of them on one hearing, and then there's poetry that moves, and you can hear it and you can bring it into yourself enough to appreciate it on one listening. And I'm very sensitive to both, mm-hmm. though I tend to write the latter. that one is really nice. That's a real nice, nice recitable, approachable, and it moves. It's got a lot of depth to it too.
Uh-huh,
you know,
uh-huh.
Rereading would bring into it.
Well, I like for poetry to be an invitation.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the poem should say, "Come sit."
Right.
Come sit. Let's tea.
Let's listen. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's what I strive for.
Okay. Richard, you wanted to say you're leaning towards.
When I hear poetry that's good, I get images, clear images in my head, and I was wondering what you find is good poetry. Is it the images? Is it the emotional connection? Help me to mm-hmm. share what you think of as just, I mean, not just okay, I mean really, really good poetry.
Images, cadence, line structure, excuse me, a very good use of allegory. If I can find the lesson, or if I can find the purpose of the piece, if I can hear it, if I can identify the voice that's speaking. I'd have to identify with the poem to know that it's a good poem. But to look at the anatomy of the poem and see that it works, you know, that it has rhythm, that it does move, that the imagery has been spread, pulled, stretched, and the metaphors have been stretched and manipulated and in such a way that you just go, So is that have that guttural response to it. I mean, all of that.
And what I, as a someone who's trying to write, are you going for great poetry all the time, or are you just, are you trying to, yeah, what are you reaching for, or are you not? Are you just looking for, you tell that story that needs to be told?
Well, when I'm writing, I want it to be good poetry. I want it to, I break all the rules, but I know the rules. So I want it to be a voice that's heard, but heard differently. So yeah, I rewrite. I spend a lot of time editing and rewriting and editing and rewriting. You know, it's kind of like, you know, if you're a fancy girl who likes lots of jewelry, you put it all on, and then you just start taking away. Until, you know, it's like, okay, so I can wear, like, just two bangles, and I don't need eight pair of things in my ear. I can, like, do two ear bobs and two bracelets.
You have that problem,
Paul? No, sometimes, yes, I do. I sent out a little Christmas poem for some friends this week, and I really liked it, you know. It was kind of strange, but I liked it. And so I sent it on just a page, you know, and I don't make it too long, you know, because I know my friends have short attention spans. But one of my poet friends sat back and edited it for me, right, and took out all the wonderful phrases I liked. You know, all those strange, weird phrases that seemed to mean something but didn't mean anything at all. And she just left it as this very, you know, nice sort of prosaic, pleasant little piece, you know. I said, "Gee, that's a shame." I says, "All those little fandangle things I like so much." She says, "I want to do something with them. You know, that's the reason I wrote the damn thing."
But you know, think about it. Think about it. Like,
yes.
it's the fat you cut away.
Yes.
Freeze it. You know, put it somewhere. Gather it. Gather all those little snippets up.
It's going to go into the fruitcake at the end of the year.
Right. Recycle
sure.
them.
Well, talking about that, one of the questions we like to ask authors, poets, artists, whatever, is to pick some favorites. So could you pick three poets that you think everybody really, really, really needs to read while they are here in this world?
Or the ones that you can't live without, you know, who are your...
My heroes.
Your heroes, yeah.
Who move me. Mary Oliver. Uh-huh. That's right
there.
Oh,
yes.
Hafiz.
Uh-huh.
Hafiz, you said?
Hafiz, uh-huh. The, you know,
oh,
Sufi
yes.
poet
yeah,
in the 1300s.
Right.
Rumi.
Okay. Jalaluddin Rumi.
Yes, yeah. are people who really speak to me and uh-huh. move me, and I read all three of them
right.
at least three or four times a week.
All right.
You know, I could go on and on about
right.
favorites. I mean, Langston Hughes.
Uh-huh.
When I think of classic poems, uh-huh. the first poet that my grandmother ever read to me was Georgia Douglas.
Uh-huh.
It was a slave poet.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about the way she writes and George Moses Horton
uh-huh.
write
uh-huh.
in that lyrical, almost hymnal,
uh-huh.
Very eloquent. There's something that just like pricks at my bones,
uh-huh.
you know, just rattles my bones at a time when voices of black people were so
mm-hmm.
disenfranchised, as
mm-hmm.
was their bodies, but particularly their voices.
Mm-hmm.
And that they wrote through that.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of always go back, you know, here I am all the way back to the 1300s, except
mm-hmm.
for Mary Oliver.
Mm-hmm.
But those are people that are like my bookends that kind of keep
mm-hmm.
me balanced. There are tons of contemporary writers and poets that I go to for nurturance.
Mm-hmm.
But these are the people who really feed me.
Which translator for Hafiz do you like? There's this Australian guy.
I know who you're talking
yeah.
about. And I have several of his books, and I can't
yeah.
even. There's a Turkish translator that we have one of his books.
Mm-hmm. Hafiz is sort of like people do bibliomancy with Hafiz.
That's true.
They'll open
mm-hmm.
the book and they'll you know, pick a passage that would answer their question.
Right.
They're fascinating.
Really?
Oh, yes. Yeah, he's a wonderful poet.
Yeah, yeah, I know the poet, but I didn't know there were people who were using it that way.
Oh, yeah. It's you know, it's sort of de rigueur if you're, you know, particularly Persian culture.
He was affectionately known as the tongue of the invisible.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. You know, and Rumi was referred to by Emerson as the poet's poet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, and of course, Rumi is and has been for, because of Coleman Barks' popularization.
And Coleman is my most famous translator for Rumi.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's made Rumi the most accessible popular poet in America for well over a decade now. Uh-huh. I mean, Rumi is the best-selling poet in America through Coleman Barks' translations. I tend to be a little more stodgy and like the more scholarly aspects of Rumi, but the you know, like Nicholson, the earlier poets, or Chittick, Bill Chittick, who does who's a more of a philosopher, but is also a very good Persian scholar. Yeah.
Well, one thing I want to do is let our listeners know about your books before we.
Tell them the titles and where they can find them.
You've got Conjure Blues, which I really enjoyed reading. Your latest is Breath of the Song. I believe that's your most recent.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And you've got some others in between there.
Well, there's Dead on Arrival, and there's Dead on Arrival and New Poems. And when I received the 2003 North Carolina Award in Literature, we did a celebratory commemorative chapbook called Singing a Tree into Dance.
Uh-huh.
So all of these books are available, particularly at Regulator Bookstore.
Okay.
At
our wonderful sponsor.
Our wonderful sponsor, my wonderful publisher, Carolina Wren Press. Uh-huh. Books are available. Uh-huh. Bookstore over in Raleigh, Quill Ridge. And please go to your local Barnes & Nobles, if that's the way you got to do it, and ask them to order it.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. They do. They will respond.
They will order it. And if you order enough of them, they will actually begin to stock it generally.
This is true. Mm-hmm. This is true.
Do you have anything that you're working on right now? I mean, you've got your Poet Laureate business for the year to be involved with, but do you have another
long-term
manuscript
plans?
That
I do.
Yeah. Okay.
There's another poetry manuscript that's probably ready.
Uh-huh.
But for about 10 years now, I've been working on a novel.
All right.
It's a historical novel. It's written in the voice of the spirit of a slave girl who perishes in a southern mansion fire. That's all I'm telling you.
Okay.
Mm.
The name?
Dandelion.
Do you have a title yet?
Dandelion.
Dandelion.
Dandelion. It started out, I thought I was going to be writing for that sweet 13 to 18 girls age.
Yeah, young adult, as it's called.
Right.
That's strange.
But there's some pretty heavy-duty things in Dandelion. And I needed to address issues of miscegenation. And I just didn't think it would be appropriate. I wasn't sure that I knew how to write to water it down enough for that age group. So I decided it was not for that audience, that it's a period novel. And I'm having so much fun with this character.
Mm-hmm. Is she set in North Carolina or somewhere? Where else in the South?
Well, you know,
perhaps.
I was inspired. When Governor Hunt was governor, he used to have these very frequent invitations to artists to the mansion. I mean, like all the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this particular visit, I was really feeling bad, and just did not feel like hobnobbing with all the pretty people.
Mm-hmm.
So I found this corridor that really said, "Do not enter." I asked one of the guards, I said, "What will happen if I go down this hallway?" And he said, "Nothing will happen if I don't see you." go down the hallway.
How very nice.
So I slipped down this hallway, and what it was just one of the corridors of the mansion that I think was being renovated, and they hadn't gotten to it. So there were just empty rooms. There were just empty rooms that looked like they needed refurbishing. Well, I found this tiny sitting room. There was one chair and a small fireplace and a small table. And I had a cup of tea, and I went in, and I just sat there. And the story literally came out of the fireplace. This little girl just presented herself to me. And I went flying out of there about 20 minutes later, and found my date that evening. Like, we gotta go. And all the way home, I couldn't stop talking about this girl. And I've been writing ever since.
That's beautiful.
I just need to finish the book. So it's fun. She's incredibly talkative, and she's an old soul now, but she started out with me as this, this child, and just told me a whole lot of stuff. So she takes her time, therefore I'm taking my time, and she's very instructive and directive about what's going on, and she will tell me, sorry, I don't know who you're writing about right now, but that is not me. I am not in this chapter. Wrong girl. So I pay attention to that nuance. I've done a lot of research for this to answer your question. No, it's not a North Carolina setting. It could be anywhere in the Southeast in the 1800s.
Sort of generic, though.
Yes. Yeah. But I've traveled throughout the Southeast researching governorships that were slaveholders, looking at scores of documents, scores of bills of sale, property documents where slaves are listed, where children are listed. Done a lot of research on the flora and fauna and architecture of mansions and landscape. And
See, people don't realize sometimes how much research goes into a novel, particularly a historic novel. And that's what helps make it real. Well, I do want to say we want you on when that book is ready to go. And when you're ready to talk about it, please. And we would to have you on regularly, as a matter of fact.
Well, actually,
anything that comes out.
Yeah, next time, let us know when your next chapbook comes out. We'd really like to feature it and have you back on.
Well, we'll do it. I have some manuscripts ready, so I will definitely let you know.
Absolutely. That's fantastic.
Thank you both. Thank all three of you. It's been great.
What else do you think? What final words of wisdom do you want to put out there for people to both hear poetry, to hear rhythms in the world, and perhaps to encourage people to write them down, pay attention, as you were saying?
There are two things that I sort of really emphasize and use as markers. One is what we keep keeps us. Paying attention to our memories, to our artifacts, to what's in our family genealogy, to just what's present. What we keep keeps us. And the other is remembering to remember and speaking power into our truths. And I think if we can embrace our own voices, because for so many people, our voices are so disenfranchised. I've had women writers who've approached me and said, you know, I want to write so bad, but I have to hide my journals from my husband. He burns them.
Oh, my goodness.
He's thrown them away. Is where do we and how do we begin to give ourselves permissions to speak our own truths and to speak power into those truths? And I approach this whole writing process very differently, in that for me, art has to be functional. My writing has to be functional. And the question for me daily is who receives this? How does it help them? How does it help me? How does it help the world when it's out there?
The
speaking power
can be
into our truths.
Healing art, actually, for the piece and purpose for the person who's doing the writing,
and not just as therapy, but even for life's work. I mean, in as a fundraiser, you know, I have a master's in community economic development. It is my literary or artistic or creative brain that really has helped me be a better professional technical writer, writing the grants, going forth, making the public presentations, as I think that in our culture we handle reading and writing a little differently. It's, you know, it's always very formal, and it's always living in the intellect, and especially with children, to help people take it out of that realm and to just put it on the dining room table, where you really see it and you can really speak to it. And that's the advice. I tell people, keep journals. We're going into the holiday season for over 30 years now. I keep holiday diaries. And it's what happened at the dinner table. Who ain't talking to who this year?
Yeah, that, the secret that itself is a novel. I can see right. that right now.
You know, the secret that so-and-so at the end of the table thing don't nobody know, but everybody know it, but we just ain't talking about it. I mean, what's going on? Everything from what people wore to the recipes. Right. There's stories in our recipes.
Right.
You know, there's stories in the things that make us who we are. It's just keeping notes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I keep shopping lists.
Mm-hmm.
There's a story sometimes in my grocery list.
So the fodder of your poetry, of your life, and your art is in your life. So just go out there and pay attention. And as you pay attention, you've got all the materials you need to create wonderful art. And we all want to hear it.
Thank you all. Thanks, Richard, for hanging around.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Jackie. Yeah,
thanks, Jackie.
Thanks so much, and for being willing to come back again.
Thank you, Audrey.
Okay. Thank us all.